Hey, welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Thank you all. Chef Terry today, I'm sad to say, is under the weather, so I'm flying solo with Miss Tina Noel, our producer here from Large Media.
Yep.
Hi, Tina.
Hello. I will do my best to pretend I know how to cook.
All right.
And when I don't, I will ask you lots of questions.
We have a very lively audience today. They're going to make up for the chef's lively banter. Right? Abigail is here, our brand new summer intern. Looking forward to working with her throughout the summer.
Yep.
And by the way, I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including the one right downstairs, Lola, or if you're going to Wicked, you know, Carlisle Room is right across the street. Super fun. Palace Kitchen.
Lots of delicious things at Carlisle Room.
Anyway, we have a big show. Chef Brittany Bartoleman is going to be here from the Dahlia Lounge and Dahlia Bakery. She is normally just in the baker's corner, but she's going to join us for a little trivia at the end of the 2 hours, and she's going to help out in Terry's absence. It's the 4th of July, so many things going on the barbecue grill. I'm going to have a little chat about charcoal, because sometimes people don't realize that there's some differences between the style of charcoal that you buy, like do you buy briquettes, do you buy hardwood chunk, you know, all that sort of thing. So we're going to discuss that later in the show. We're going to make a meal out of what's in your fridge. And apparently, Tina, you have some odds and ends that are
so many odds and ends. You know, Tom, I went plant-based, so there are so many vegetables that I do not know what to do with, so I'm going to need some help.
Wow. Are you totally plant-based now?
Totally plant-based.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
And how do you feel?
I feel wonderful.
Yeah.
So no dairy, no eggs, no salt, no sugar, no oil.
No cheese?
No cheese. Yeah, it's been really interesting. The most fascinating thing, two things. I've learned to cook a lot more than I ever have before, and my brain is clearer. Something that I just didn't even expect.
Uh-huh.
I just did it to try it, and my brain is very clear. I'm more focused. I sleep better.
But you still sip on a glass of wine, or you're not?
Of course. I mean, let's
not get crazy.
Let's not.
Yeah.
Right. I mean.
So I was going to say that
still
might
sane.
Have. Yeah, that might have something to do with it. Today, we have much more to talk about. Of course, I said tasty trivia. That's at the end of our 2 hours. Let's jump right into Ordinary to Extraordinary.
Yeah, this is a super fun segment that we like to play, whereby I'm going to give you an ordinary dish, and you are allowed two things, maybe some technique or maybe some ingredients you can switch around to make it even better, something extraordinary.
You know,
you guys have gone off the rails.
Food is a life source, so is there really any ordinary food?
I'm going to say...
I mean, without any of it, you're...
Jicama.
You're dead.
I feel like jicama's pretty ordinary.
You nailed it. That is horrible.
Right? Nothing. Yeah. Thanks.
No, it's not horrible. What I love about jicama is that it's a texture, much more than a flavor, right? It's really a crunchy, delicious...
So how do you make it
texture.
Extraordinary? There you go. It is relatively ordinary. What you doing? That's a curveball. It wasn't on your show sheet today.
Well, you know, I never used to eat jicama at all. I tried, you know, early on in my chef career, it was the new potato, right? Remember, people were planting jicama thinking they were going to get rich. And it just never took off. And it just doesn't bring much to the table other than texture. So I just kind of ignored it for years and years and years until I had my first banh mi sandwich. Mm. So you know what the banh mi is, right? It's a little French rolls or Vietnamese roll, kind of like a demi-baguette. And it's typically toasted, and then onto that goes some sort of mayo and a skewer of something, whether it's tofu or pork or chicken. And then they make a little pickled, not so much of a slaw, but not a relish, but a pickled vegetable combo. And typically it is jicama, possibly some cucumber, possibly some carrot. And that's all just soaked in a sweet vinegar. And that's put on the sandwich, and it's just a delicious, delightful crunch to go along with your banh mi. And that's how I got back into jicama. Mm-hmm. And so, essentially, I use it as a pickle, and you can pickle it so many ways, using beet juice or anything, you know, to give it color, because it's plain white. But it's a fun little texture vegetable for me now.
It's a carrier. Its job is pretty much the crunch.
Yeah, it's a carrier. It's like tofu, right? It's a carrier of other flavors.
All right, so now you know how to play the game. Let's keep going.
Okay.
How about your strawberry shortcake, your ordinary strawberry shortcake, your basic one?
Uh-huh.
How do you turn that into something super extraordinary?
Whoo! Don't mess up the shortcake, and don't make it in December.
And don't buy it at the grocery store.
I mean, everyone does what they feel like they want to do that way, but if you are going to buy it at the grocery store, at least buy local berries to go with it. So I was at the at the market the other day, and there's in front and center a big sack of California Driscoll strawberries. And then right about 10 feet away, kind of not in the corner so much, but just over there.
Look over here. We're not from California.
Were these gorgeous local red strawberries that tasted delicious, had flavor. So that's the first thing is buy the – if you have to buy store-bought shortcake, at least give it a little – put a butter on it and toast it on the grill on a cast iron pan or something like that, and then put your local strawberries on top of your shortcake. You know, make some effort for it. Yeah. We had one yesterday. There's a shortcake recipe in my Dahlia Bakery book, and maybe when Brittany's on later, she can talk about why it's so good. But that crispy, crunchy edge on the outside of the shortcake and those strawberries that are red throughout – you don't even need to put sugar on them, right? You set them on the counter, and they macerate themselves. And it's just a lovely June tradition that shouldn't be missed.
Yep. So buy local is your key to making that one extraordinary.
And get some of that heavy, what's the name of that dairy that comes in the glass jars? Some of that heavy.
Creme fraiche?
No. There's a local dairy.
Oh, sorry.
Huh? Twin Falls or Twin something, yeah. Get some of that cream. You don't even need to whip it. Just pour a little bit over top. It is so rich and delicious.
Great desserts in our backyard. All right, Tom, this is everywhere on 4th of July. Potato salad. Just your basic old potato salad. What are you doing with that to make it a little
more interesting? I'm getting rid of the mayonnaise. I'm much more of a German-style potato salad, right?
Me too. No
go
mayo.
With vinegar. Go with olive oil. Put some bacon crumbles or if you wanted there. But get rid of the mayonnaise. And add mustard. Use mustard as your spice for it. To me, that's just a delicious combination.
What type of mustard are you going for there?
Typically for me, it's seedy. Mm-hmm. As in, not as in trashy, but seedy as in whole
stone
seeds.
Stone ground, kind of?
Yeah. Whole seeds, stone ground. Because I want to see it. Because when you use Dijon and something like that, it wants to emulsify into your dressing, and then it becomes mayonnaise, right? Mm-hmm. So it gets a different texture. Whereas the seedy one is less apt to do that.
I like a little tang to mine, just to like a little. Is that the vinegar? It's going to add that.
It's the vinegar, And just remember, potato salad is life. Is like life. Once in a while, you run into a pickle, and really, I love a little pickle in my potato salad.
You just soured the whole dish.
Oh. Up next, we're going to talk charcoal for a whole segment about how it can be your friend on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Time to go back to the Seattle kitchen here at the Hot Stove Society on Cairo Radio. Thank you for being with us. It's an exciting summer day again. Chef Terry is off today under the weather. I was last week, so there you go. It's tit for tat. Charcoal. Tina, you had put some charcoal on my list because you don't know anything about charcoal.
That's a true story.
And when you go to the store...
I'm like, what? It's like buying toothpaste. There's like 800 different kinds, and I don't know what, and I don't understand why it would even make a difference. You just light it on fire. So you just get the one in that blue and white bag. You know that one?
Kingsford, I think that's called. Yeah.
That's the one you get, right? Uh-huh. I don't know. So, yeah, I saw this article in Epicurious Magazine and noticed there are some nuances there and some things that you could watch out for. So I turn to you.
So you turn to me. Well, you know, there's so many different kinds of charcoal, right? So there's the briquettes. And then the one that makes me the most crazy, it's called Matchlight. And they're just briquettes that are pre-soaked in lighter fluid. And they're just gross. They are gross.
What's gross about them? What do you mean?
Well, they're easy. But because you put a match to them and they light, but that fluid just stays in there throughout the process.
It smells very chemically
of your cooking, and I can't imagine it's any good for you personally.
Yeah,
as the smoke comes up and envelops your fish or your steak, and especially if you're doing anything low and slow where it's on there for a very long time, you know, for a hot seared steak, maybe it's not that big a deal, but something low and slow like a pork butt that you have on for 5 or 6 hours. I just think you can do better. So get a chimney. They're $10. Get what they call a chimney. Put some paper underneath in the bottom. It takes one piece of newspaper. Put your briquettes in and light it up, and you've got that. So briquettes are just ground charcoal, right? And they are put together oftentimes with kind of a clay paste. So nothing that's bad for you, but I would say 90 or 95% of your charcoal is wood. and the other 5% is a mixture to hold that press together. And they are good in several ways. I think for long cooking, like if you, when I was down at the, being a judge at the Jack Daniel's World Barbecue Invitational, many of the competitors, 150 competitors, were using like Royal Oak charcoal or Kingsford charcoal. Some of those teams were sponsored by those teams, but they do a very nice job of steady heat. They don't add a ton of flavor. They're not intensely flavored, so that just because you want something cooked over wood doesn't mean you want it intensely cooked over wood, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same way I don't smoke with fruit wood, right? It's too sappy. It's too strong for a five-hour smoke. It'll actually put a syrup on the lid of your smoker and drip onto your food. It's so gross in that way. So I don't. I use a hardwood with less sap for smoking. So anyway, so in charcoal briquettes, you get a real kind of a dry, steady heat. It'll go for a long time, easily adjustable with the dampers. When you get into things, you'll see on the shelf of the grocery store, you'll see hardwood lump, hardwood charcoal, natural wood charcoal. These are woods that are literally lit on fire, and then as soon as they get to that charcoal stage, where there's still some, I don't know what the word would be, but it's still burnable, but it's not, it hasn't burned out. They put a shower right on top of it, stop it from burning, and then dry it, and then bag it, and that's what you're seeing in these hardwood lumps. That burns much hotter, much more, less steady. You'll get hot spots with that type of charcoal. You have to be very aware of it, and it's very much, it's got flavor, a natural wood flavor that will or will not intensely flavor your food that you're cooking over top of it. So I love that kind of charcoal. I'll even smoke with it sometimes when I want a stronger smoke. Mm-hmm. But that's one where if you're getting oak or mesquite, or you might actually get some more individual pecan. You might get some more individual flavors. And it's more what I use. I rarely use briquettes, but I tend to use the hardwood chunk. It's much more expensive, and it's much more volatile.
And where do you get it? Are you? Is it available anywhere? Or are you,
anywhere. Okay. Anywhere. And you'll find things like at Sutter Home and Hearth, where they sell grills, a big variety of grills. You'll find there that they have like green egg charcoal, literally made for the green egg. And that is all hardwood chunk charcoal. And you think, well, green egg, you think slow cooking, right? So, that's a hardwood chunk. And it's like $40 a bag. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
But
worth
it is what it is. I don't know. If I was going that direction, I would probably, like down at Mutual Fish on Rainier Avenue, they carry this big chunk, really meaty mesquite charcoal that burns for a long time. It does spark and spit a lot in the beginning, but once it gets going, it's an interesting thing. The charcoal that I have not figured out, and I don't know if anyone in our audience has, there's a thing called tan charcoal, T-H-A-A-N, from Thailand, and you'll see the words Pok Pok on it, P-O-K-P-O-K, and it's been, I believe it's a brand by the guy that has Pok Pok Restaurant down in, we had him on the show last
Portland?
Week.
Andy Ricker,
Yeah. We had him on the show. But anyway, Ricker. I cannot get that stuff to burn.
Oh, funny.
I put it on a red-hot charcoal fire the other day at the farm, and it just sits there. And it get a little bit of glow going, but generally it needs a gas flame under it, and then you get the charcoal flavor. But it's just I just haven't figured it out.
Now, when you're choosing your charcoals and all of that, how are you choosing your meat? Is there any difference between, you know, if you're fish or...
Not really. It's more about time. And then when you're choosing how to use the charcoal, it's more about on the grill, where do you put it? Are you going indirect heat? Are you going right over your serious heat? Are you working the edge of the fire? I often edge cook, which is where I kind of... It's not totally indirect. I kind of move my fish or my something that I want to go a little bit lower on, maybe a piece of chicken, to the edge of the fire, rather than directly over the hot part. But I'm still getting more intense heat than indirect. So, one of the things that I liked about that article that you gave me was that to think about things that you can do on your grill that are not necessarily a steak or a piece of chicken, like a dessert, like a cake. And this is where you have to have a nice cast iron pan. But I think the point that I liked about it was not everything has to have that intensity, right? When it's, we, Terry and I often say, if you're going to start to grill, use the grill, right, for everything if you can. So if you put your cast iron pan on the fire and indirect or direct, or however it is, with your, you have to butter it first, put your cake batter in, blah, blah, blah. That cake batter is going to pick up a little bit of that smoke. It's only going to be in there 20 minutes, right, for it to cook. But it does pick up a little bit, and it really changes your dessert in a way that you might not have thought about. And that goes for cornbread or focaccia or anything like that that you want. Just another layer, interesting layer of flavor would be awesome. And so that's something, when you do that or you grill some peaches to put on top of that cake or something, you can really make a campfire dessert that I think is interesting. Have you ever done that?
Yeah, no. I mean, I've eaten them. I haven't done it.
Yeah.
I've enjoyed them. On that note, what is your go-to on the dessert grill?
Well, for me, the go-to is like grilled peaches with whipped cream or vanilla ice cream or you name it. That's kind of my go-to. I don't tend to camp. My idea of camping is the Ritz-Carlton. but if I was out there and I would be thinking more in the cornbread area, right? More savory in the cast iron pan. But if let's say you're out there for a birthday party, and making a campfire cake in a birthday in a cast iron pan would be super fun. So bring a box mix and do it up out there, you know?
That was one of the things that you taught me about the cornbread, is the box to sort of add to the regular box to make it easier. That Jiffy, recommended the box of Jiffy cornbread.
What's Jiffy? It's like 65 cents a box or something like that.
But you add some corn to that, and now you got yourself some cornbread.
Exactly. All right, we're going to jump into questions from our listeners. If anybody in the audience wants to come up, please come on do. I'm Chef Tom Douglas. We're in the Seattle kitchen at the Hot Stove Society on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio. Woo! I'm Tom Douglas, and we are joined by some of our audience members today. And of course, Tina, you have gone to our Facebook page and picked some questions from our listeners off there, too.
I most certainly have. Our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, if you'd like to check it out, is full of fun conversations, questions. People share recipe information. Sometimes they bicker. Sometimes they disagree with you. But it's full of activity, and we've got lots of questions from listeners today.
I do find, being the host of this show, that having an opinion on some things does cause quite a stir.
Oh, yes. You have gotten into it. What? There was one recently, the cheeseburger. Was it the cheeseburger one?
I don't know. I know cottage cheese was a problem. Oh, the salted water pasta. Yeah.
The salted water pasta. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. People got mad.
Chef Charters is back there right now just shaking her head.
But you know what's really fun about the show is that we have a live audience. And so right now, our darling audience member here, Janice, has a question and some comments for you.
All right. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to say, about 3 weeks ago, Terry and you talked about putting herbs in salads.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just in the dressing, but in the salads.
Whole leaf herbs, like all the tender herbs. Yeah.
And, wow, my husband and I tried that, and we won't have a salad any other way. I mean, it was great. And the one that was very surprising, I think it was Terry that said something about try some mint. And I thought, boy, I don't know if I want to do it. But tried it, and we really liked it.
Yeah.
So we did oregano and thyme, tarragon. I mean, are there other herbs that you would suggest we try?
All of them, honestly. Chervil, parsley, cilantro, mint. All the different basils, whether it's the Italian basil or it's the Thai basil, garlic, chives, all of those, as long as they're soft and edible. Like rosemary doesn't work very well, right? It's too intense.
Sure, too
but good. Lovage, depending on the season, early spring lovage is much better than hot late summer lovage. It's too intense at that point. But, you know, you think of arugula in the same way, that nutty flavor of arugula. But all of those work beautifully, as you have found out. And we credited it, I credited it to the influx of Vietnamese cooking here in Seattle. And I never, when you go and have food like that, it's full of herbs. And it's just a delicious and delightful way to accomplish big flavor. Because let us not forget that lettuce has very little flavor on its own oftentimes. It has bitterness or sweetness, but generally not a lot of full flavor.
Right. So. Well, and I'll also say your recipe for the ranch dressing, half mayonnaise, half buttermilk, fabulous.
Why does everyone love ranch so much? I think it's such a funny phenomena in our world. Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you, Janice. Up next is Camille.
Hi, Tom. Hello. It's very impressive to see you in person.
Are you so sad that Terry's under the weather today?
We've actually met Terry.
Oh, okay, good.
But we haven't met
so
you.
So you're not sad then?
I'm a little sad. I wish Terry was here, but that's okay.
Me too. I miss my buddy.
Yeah. So you were talking about charcoal. When we were younger and more energetic, we used charcoal all the time. And now we're lazy. And so we got the George Foreman grill, which does steak and hamburgers really well, and that's about all we ever do with it. So I wondered if you had any suggestions on how to use a non-charcoal grill in a manner that makes the food more similar to charcoal or different things that you can do on a electric grill, whatever you call it.
Well, there's one base ingredient that I use, let's say, in all my rub line, right? I have a line of spice rubs, and the one base ingredient I use there that helps give me some of that flavor is smoked paprika. And so that kind of gives you a head start on the outdoor charcoal flavor.
Okay.
And then you build from there. Sometimes I add brown sugar to those so that I get the caramelization. When you brown brown sugar on your electric grill, it's like creme brulee, right? It doesn't taste like sugar anymore. It starts to get a little bit bitter and caramelized and delicious. And that, again, gives you some of that outdoor grill caramelization flavor. So those are two ways to achieve what you're trying to get to, which is a little bit of a smoky quality without the charcoal.
Great.
The other thing I'll say, a side note to that, was it must be 25 years ago, maybe 30. I'd say probably 25 years ago. I was hired by the George Foreman Grill people to promote their double-size grill. I was a big dude, and we did a double-size George Foreman Grill commercial on my deck at my house in Ballard. And I was supposed to make all this money and never saw a dime.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's call George Foreman.
Let's call.
All right, Tom. From our Facebook page, we have Evelyn Tezana. She asks, any suggestion for something savory for rhubarb? I'm a little over sweets right now, she says.
Well, I make it's a little late for spring, but I make this kind of cool spring chicken dish where I make a green herb marinade, and it's lots of garlic. It's almost like a pesto, herb pesto, but I marinate the chicken in it, and then I grill it, and something like a pickled rhubarb to finish that, because you got the unctuousness of the herbs and the heaviness of the marinade, and you know I do my chicken skin on, and it's got all the charcoal grill flavors, brightening it up at the end of that with a little pickle, whether it's rhubarb or jicama or a combination thereof. It would be a beautiful way to use that in a savory way compared to, say, strawberry rhubarb pie.
Delicious. All right, Arlene Trebon asks, she's craving steak tartare and wonders if there's any good recipes for her to try.
What?
You can have beet tartare.
Yeah, I'll have beet tartare. Sounds delicious.
Steak tartare is such a big dish all over the world. It's astonishing.
Yeah.
When I was just in Sweden, I saw it everywhere. Copenhagen, everywhere. Of course, when you go to Italy, it's on every Piemontese menu. Mm-hmm. It's called carne cruda. And it's not just steak tartare. It is an 8-ounce ball of raw flesh.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. And they eat it very much like they would eat a steak. And, you know, many of us in the audience, who likes their steak rare? You know what the temperature of the inside of a rare steak is? There was a group of people put their hands up. It's 100 degrees. What's raw steak when you leave it out on the counter? 90 degrees, 80 degrees, depending on the season, right? So it's when you're eating even seared steak on the outside, you're still eating a pretty rare steak on the inside. So it is. It's not as gross maybe as people want to think it is sometimes, like you think it is.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like I have had it and I liked the flavor. I liked how it tasted a lot. It was just getting my brain around it.
Right.
But as I told you before, switching to plant-based, I've had to get my head around a whole bunch of vegetables that I never liked before, and I found that just eat them.
Yeah.
Just eat them and things change. Your palate changes all of the time, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
So what do you do with that steak tartare?
So I like to use a tender cut, less fatty cut. So that would be filet mignon, right? It doesn't have near the fat that, say, a New York does or many, many other cuts. But so filet mignon, I chop it. I like to leave it chopped not into a paste, but into so that it still has texture. So I think we're looking at maybe quarter inch to eighth inch little chunks of beef. I don't like to over manipulate it, so I'll spread it out onto a plate. I'll drizzle it, say, with a little mustard and olive oil mix that has maybe a little horseradish in it. But I try to let the steak flavors shine. That's what you're eating. If you start adding raw onions, and you see a lot of sets with raw onions and capers and all sorts of things, right?
You're just hiding the flavor at that point.
You're not going to taste the raw beef. Raw beef has very little flavor, just like raw fish. Mm-hmm. You had sushi, right? And it has very little flavor. It's cooking the fish is what gives it more flavor. Same with cooking the beef.
When you are preparing something like that at home, to me that sounds a little scary, like that it would make me sick or something.
No. I really don't think so. I eating raw beef is raw beef. You just have to handle it properly, whether you're at home or at a restaurant. And then to finish, I like to do thick shavings with your peeler of Reggiano Parmesan, right? Nice, thick, crystallized, old, you know, Stravecchio. Stravecchio is 24 months aged minimum on the Parmesan, right? So, and then bigger chunks of flake salt so that you get a crispy bite of that salt because the meat is very soft. So you want to add some texture to it. So, but I like to keep it very simple.
What are you pairing that with?
Lots of grilled baguette.
Oh, yeah. And what are you pairing that with?
I don't know. Maybe a little Chateauneuf du Pape or something. You know, Chateauneuf du Pape tends to be peppery. Mm-hmm. And pepper and raw beef sounds good to me together.
Yum, yum, yum.
Peppery.
I brought some Chateauneuf du Pape back from France last time I was there with Thierry Routureau. Okay, here's a quick one. What great restaurants have you been to in the last few weeks? Somebody asks. Who was it? Cynthia Flash, what restaurants have you been to?
Well, I've been in, I guess the last city I was in was Copenhagen, and I went to a place called Braa, I think that's the name of it, right on the inlet there. You know, Copenhagen's on canals, and it was delicious and much more casual than I was expecting, which was great. Because, you know, that Nordic cuisine thing has taken off into these esoteric areas that isn't necessarily my style. So this was great to have a real, what
authentic
I thought,
experience.
Authentic Nordic cuisine. So, yum. Sounds so good. Up next, we're going to talk about a little summer sauces that you can make, cook or no cook. There's all sorts of ways to go about these. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. All right, we are back. It's time for summer sauces here in the Hot Stove Society kitchen on Cairo Radio. Chef Brittany Bartleben has joined me a few segments early.
Hi.
Looking forward to that. Nice to have you.
So nice to be here.
You know, we're going to talk something savory, which we don't do very often.
I know. I'm really excited to be included in the savory talk.
Before we get too far down this summer sauces, and hopefully this doesn't take the whole segment, but we'll see. You just did a big fancy dinner at Prosser Farm.
I did. We did 11 courses, myself and Chef Kyle Johnson, who right now is the chef at Home Remedy. But he's been around the company at Sea Town, Dahlia Lounge, Cantina Linea. So he really is a very knowledgeable chef. So he was a good one for me to team up with because I have a little savory experience, but I needed someone good to hold my hand a little bit. And then I also did like 3 dessert courses because I'm me, and that's what I do.
Because why not?
It was so cool. Pretty much every course was vegetarian, with the exception of our main, which, speaking of tartare, we did beef tartare, a little bite of that, on a little cornmeal cheesy cracker that we made with corn that was from the farm 2 years ago that we milled last year. And so it just has this wonderful nubby texture. It's like a grown-up Cheez-It with that beef tartare on there. And we used some row 7 beets that we diced small and mixed that in with the beef. Have you heard of these?
I have not heard of them. Row 7 is Dan Barber's new seed company.
Right,
I know
that
my wife has been doing some seed trials with that.
This was one of them. And the beets are made for eating raw. You don't have to cook them in any way. So they're a little bit more tender. They were golden and so delicious, and they just diced up really small, mixed into that beef tartare. It was really, really delicious. And then, of course, we did the ribeye with golden beets for the main. My favorite course was just a, every guest got a big bowl of buttered fava beans with a little parsnip bushi on there. And a parsnip bushi is, Kyle had done this in the past with some overwintered parsnips, dehydrated them, cooked them in salt water, and then dehydrated them. So they have this really salty flavor. And so it was just this pure buttery umami flavor that we tossed with those beets. And to me, it just, it's such a delicacy, and you just feel like a king to have a giant bowl of buttered favas, because the, I don't know if you guys have ever tried to get to the fava bean. We actually gave each guest a fava bean to try and get open, so they could see just how hard it was to get that big bowl of fava bean.
The effort
that went into that. Yeah, so that was actually my personal favorite. We did a little griddled olive oil cake with some of the cherries that we're getting from Chinook Winery out there, which are really delicious, and some whipped Titan cheese with that.
Lovely. Did you go actually over to the winery and pick the cherries?
We did, yeah. Wow. That was really cool. And it took us 10 minutes. I mean, they are just heavy with fruit right now. Did I do that?
You know, that's how I ended up getting a place in Prosser, was 30 years ago. I was invited over for the Merlot release party, the Chinook Merlot release party, and that's one of the things we did, is they did it on that Father's Day weekend when the cherries were coming in. They released their Merlot. We had a nice little lamb picnic. And that's how I ended up falling in love with Prosser.
I don't know how you could go out to their Chinook Winery and just take 10 minutes and have 25 pounds of cherries all of a sudden. Just the hills and the beautiful weather. And, yeah, we were both ready to tell them all to go to hell and move out there ourselves. And then last course, because I can't leave well enough and alone, I got to talk about this anise hyssop coming that's growing at Prosser right now.
Don't you think that's probably the most underutilized, awesome
Absolutely.
Herb?
Absolutely. And the beauty of having this farm, it's...
But you can't buy it anywhere.
You can't buy it. Yeah. And what I love about having this farm available to us is that we can tell Sarah and Jackie what we liked about one thing last year or what we didn't like, and they will then cater the growing process or the to how we want them to be. So... they found that if they don't let the anise hyssop flower, if they snip it earlier and send it over, it's sweeter. Tom, you may remember this. At Chef Plant, I gave you a little bite of just plucked from the bud anise hyssop, and he did this like full body undulation.
Have you all had anise hyssop before? It's a discovery that's worth finding. It's an easy grow.
It's so easy.
I don't know why it isn't in the marketplace.
It tastes like a root beer float. So what I did was I made a marshmallow out of that anise hyssop. And so right there, you've got the milky, gooey, creamy flavors. And then we did a cornmeal rye graham cracker, again with that same cornmeal I was talking about earlier. And then Theo Chocolate has this root beer barrel, dark chocolate, that just has little bits of root beer candies in them. And so we did that cracker with the root beer chocolate and the anise hyssop marshmallow, toasted it. It just tasted like a root beer float and a s'more, had a baby. Delicious.
Did you do it over a charcoal fire?
We wanted to do it in the new fire pit. And then Sarah said, we wanted to do bourbon and s'mores at the end. And Sarah and Jackie were like, they will never leave if we do that. So we did it indoors. And yeah, it was really fun and delicious. And everyone was stuffed to the gills. Yeah. Amazing wine. Just super good wine. Jackie knows her stuff.
So these are dinners that we put on at the farm, either for, I think, 16 or 18 people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did 16.
And I think we do 6 or 8 a season. They're on our website. Our catering team is in charge of that. And it's just are they sold out already? Yeah. They sell out pretty quickly when we announce them in March, maybe?
Yeah, I think so.
We announce usually in March. And so they're a special little treat, but they are a lot of work.
They
as
are.
As you can imagine, getting the farm ready and getting the food ready and you all coming over. And different chefs from our group host the dinners along with Jackie and Sarah Dublin, our farmer in chief. So. Good fun. I'm glad you had a good time.
It's one of those moments where I love what I do.
Uh-huh.
That it's the best. Yeah. So much fun.
All right, some quick summer sauces. You know, I'm working with Ned from the BC Wine Group, Ned Bell, and today we're doing a class, and then tomorrow night we're doing a tasting at the Palace Ballroom with BC Wines and BC Seafood. So today one of my summer sauces that I'm going to do for this particular class is a classic kind of tomatillo salsa.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to put everything on a sheet pan, put the broiler on. You can do it over the charcoal grill if you have one available to you, but put the broiler on and just scorch it literally scorch it till there's some black bits and blah, blah, blah. Chop it all up, make a sauce out of it, and then I'm going to serve it with fresh Dungeness crab on crispy homemade tortillas.
Wow.
So just a nice little starter today. So that's my idea of a quick summer sauce that is basically on a sheet pan, into the food processor, done.
Effortless.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
I mean, not to belittle your efforts, but that sounds like something any of us could pull off at home.
Is there any go-to summertime sauce that you like to make for roast chicken or a piece of fish?
I mean, I love a pesto. I'm absolutely weak in the knees with a really, really good pesto. What I love about pesto is you can make a big batch of it, and then you're enjoying it throughout the year. I throw a batch in my bechamel for my lasagna, and it just tastes like summer in the dead of winter. I'm always curious about pestos if you can utilizing like carrot tops or other herbs, or because basil is such an basil pesto is just such a beloved flavor that it seems like we could.
I'll just say carrot tops don't taste like
they
basil.
Don't.
They
okay.
don't taste like basil.
Well, yeah, but I'm just curious about like.
Well, you can
take that method.
I would suggest that. Well, I think carrot tops are interesting. Say when you're doing a flight of carrots, whether it's carrot puree with roasted carrots and carrot top pesto, or you know where you're, it's all about the carrot. It doesn't translate as well to me away from the carrot. So to me, those tops are come in handy, say, when you're making a green sauce or a green marinade, right? Throw some carrot tops in, throw some cilantro in, some basil in, whatever you have, you know, and now you're utilizing them, but it's not the driver of the flavor profile.
So you would recommend sort of a blend of different flavors in there.
Again, unless it's just all about the carrot.
Right.
And then it's, I think it's interesting to go on from there. Okay, we're going to jump to our next segment, which is...
What's in your fridge?
What's in your fridge on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen, and you are back in it on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Brittany Bartleben.
And you are the chef.
I'm the chef at the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia... Pastry chef, I should say, at the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge.
We're coming to you from the Hot Stove Society. I'm doing a class here today at the Hot Stove with Ned Bell of Vancouver, British Columbia, and he showed up, so we put him on the microphone. Hi, Ned.
Hey, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Your new book is awesome. It's a paperback version of your original book called Lure, L-U-R-E. Tina's going to put a picture of it on our page. Tell us why you're here in town.
Yeah, well, you know, similar to you, I love the ocean. The health of our ocean is crucially important to me. And because we are chefs, we get to harvest things from it and make it delicious. And so I recognized, like you did so many years ago, that the health of our oceans is challenged. The species that we draw from the oceans is continues to be challenged. And so I decided to write a book. Actually, I decided to ride my bike across Canada in the summer of 2014 to start a foundation called Chefs for Oceans. And then I decided to write a book that celebrates species from California to Alaska. Because the challenge that we face in North America is we only eat four fish. We eat some sort of salmon, some sort of tuna, some sort of whitefish. And by far the most consumed species in North America is shrimp. A lot of that shrimp comes from somewhere else. And so, you know, I wanted to remind people that there is a spectacular amount of wild American, wild Canadian seafood available to them, small-scale fisheries that we don't eat a lot of at home and or, you know, eat a lot of in restaurants that we support. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, clean, healthy protein from, you know, the place that covers two-thirds of our planet, which is the ocean. Every second breath we take comes from the ocean. We can't grow anything on land without the health of our ocean. And so Mother Nature still gives us wild fish. It's not our right to take it all. And with climate change and overfishing being two of the largest threats that face our world's oceans, how are we going to still be able to harvest from the ocean and, you know, make sure that the ecosystem and the species within it are healthy for future generations. So, you know, where I live, Indigenous and First Nations peoples have been conscious consumers for 12,000 years, long before we found our way to the shores of the East Coast, where I come from six generations of fishermen from Beer and Newfoundland. But why did we leave Newfoundland? Well, unfortunately, we took too much cod, and the fishery collapsed. And, you know, why did the Europeans and Spanish and Portuguese come to North America? Well, was fish before furs. Most people don't know that. You know, we arguably are founded on the backs of the seafood industry. And we're facing the same challenge here now. A fisheries collapse with cod, we're facing the same issues with wild salmon. And so how do we protect that iconic keystone species? You know, the only place on the planet that has five unique Pacific species is here on the West Coast. And you know, grizzlies and bears and humans and orca and
eagles
rely on that species. And so I'm sort of standing on the shoulders of you giants who sort of led the charge, but now we need hundreds of us to be championing the health of our oceans. And so, you know, how do we look at wild fish and also responsible aquaculture as a way to continue to consume seafood?
Yeah, it's such an interesting issue right now. We've had, of course, some serious setbacks with the current administration on Pebble Mine and, and the possibilities of putting the largest open-pit copper and gold mine in the headwaters of the last great salmon run left on Earth. We've certainly have screwed up plenty of our runs down here. It's a shame to see us not learn our lessons and, and try to manage it efficiently up there.
So. You know, wild salmon, you know, touches five countries in its life, the U.S., Canada, Russia, Japan and Korea. And most people think of, you know, these arbitrary borders. Well, salmon don't know those borders. They leave the rivers that they were born in and they return to that river. But when they're out there challenging and navigating sort of boat traffic and climate change and overfishing and mining and forestry and urbanization, it's just like
polar bears, sea lions.
Sure. I mean, you know, things need things to eat, but you know, more importantly, humans got in the way, get in the way continually. You know, whether it's damming of rivers and, you know, our, you know, constant looking towards how do we enhance rivers with hatcheries and things like that. So there's a lot of different curiosities, questions, concerns, and I want to be able to eat wild salmon for the next 10,000 years. So how are we going to be able to do that? Well, we can't just continue to take it all.
So what do you suggest? I mean, we were going to talk about what's in your fridge, but we're going to stick on this, I think, for a bit. Your book title is called Sustainable Seafood Recipes from the West Coast. I've often said in the last 5-10 years is that when we make a choice at the grocery store about a seafood, it is really, it used to be like, oh, I don't remember what I was supposed to eat, what I wasn't supposed to eat, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's not a viable excuse anymore. There's apps out there that will tell you exactly what you should and shouldn't be buying, and you can look at it right in the grocery store, right in front of the fish case, and make your choices. And you talked about shrimp coming from here or there. Well, it makes a difference on where they're coming from. Some places are done sustainably, some places aren't.
Yeah. Right?
So when you talk about sustainable seafood recipes from the West Coast, how do you expect the consumer, or what's the process for the consumer to make that decision and follow through on the process all the way to the dinner table?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, you got to ask a few more questions. You know, 80% of the seafood that we consume in North America is imported. Up to 90% of the seafood that we harvest is exported. So first of all, support regional, support wild American, support wild Canadian seafood. You know, if you have an opportunity to become a member of a community-supported fishery, you're doing an incredible, you know, service to your community. So eat regionally first, of course. I mean, that sort of eat local. But at the end of the day, there are opportunities for us to have that information through the Seafood Watch app, the Smart Catch program, Oceanwise, the organization that I work for in Canada. There's lots of great NGOs doing great work. But ask the questions. Where is it from? Who caught it? How is it caught? What is it, first of all? Because, you know, traceability is crucial to the labeling aspect of the seafood that we consume. But, you know, we live in Seattle. We live in Vancouver. I just came up from Portland. We have access to great sustainable seafood. Or, you know, sustainability, what is sustainability? I mean, to me, it's rebuilt, resilient, and regenerative seafood and responsible aquaculture. So ask more questions and then vote with your wallet. Support the restaurants that and the retailers that that give you those choices, and join a community-supported fishery.
I would also say it's incumbent on us as humans to spread the gospel about buying the fish.
Absolutely.
You know, you hear us talk about it in the restaurants all the time, but it's our responsibility. Just because we don't like what's happening in Pebble Mine doesn't mean we have to accept it.
Spread the word. Share it on Facebook. Yeah. And Tom, can you say where we're at with Pebble Mine? Is there anything we can do? Is there a website we can go to?
You can still go to the Corps of Engineers website and voice your displeasure. They have to respond to us. Of course, I've never gotten a response. I've been there many times. But they do have to respond to every everything, yeah. every inquiry. So that vote is coming up soon. Thank you, Ned Bell. The book is called Lure. We're doing an event here with BC Wines today at lunch and then tomorrow night at the Palace Ballroom. So thank you for being here. Appreciate
it. My pleasure. Thanks for leading the charge. I'm happy to follow.
Absolutely, and vice versa. Okay, so much for watching your fridge. Now let's move on to the Baker's Corner with Brittany Bartley. Maybe we can put a fridge in there. How does a baker deal with extra stuff in the fridge? On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Yay! Everyone's got their sandwich, so they're predisposed to clapping. Or to not clapping. I'm Tom Douglas. I'm joined by Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery.
Yes, hello.
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 And would you like to introduce our guest?
Yes, this is my new friend, Andrew Rubenstein. We met a couple of months back. We have a mutual friend, Peter Barrett, who's located out of the Hudson Valley. And he also has a podcast called Cook Pod. And he was over here visiting Andrew, who's also a local artist because he had an art show going on. And so he interviewed both of us for his podcast. And Andrew is Andrew Rubenstein of Rubenstein Bagels. And I had the opportunity to taste these bagels, and they truly are the best I've ever tasted. We're in a little bit of a bagel desert here in Seattle. Let me know if you guys agree with me. And I don't really know why that is. Andrew, maybe you can speak to that and just tell us about your process and what makes your bagels unique. I would say it's because of the sourdough starter that you're using.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. So I would say that I don't know why we have a desert here. I think personally that big, giant companies that are named after geniuses have sort of dumbed down our palate and have shoved us the sort of ultra-refined white flour that it has no flavor. They don't do any fermentation. They don't develop the dough. They don't also boil them anymore. They do steam ovens, which mm-hmm. I know some people think that that's actually a valid thing. It's just not the way I wanted to do it. I started as an artist. I really wanted to figure out a way that I could actually make money doing something with my hands. And I really enjoy working with my hands. And the idea of bagels came to me one day after eating a bagel. It's a strange thing, but I did. And I started working on a recipe. And I started talking to our friend Peter Barrett, who had a sourdough culture that he'd had for 10 years. And I thought, I really would like to have a dough that was developed and that had a tang to it, that was deeper than normal, that was moister than normal. And so he sent me his sourdough from New York. And from then on, I've been using that as my culture, which is its own sort of burden and child that I've got to carry around and take care of every day. And it's more work.
What does the TSA have to say about that when you're traveling?
Right now, I just do it in the car. But when I go on vacations, I carry that with me.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to work with... I have a cousin who is a bread scientist. She was working for Princi for a while. She's out in Illinois. And she's helped me develop the fermentation process as well. What I learned over time was that by doing a long fermentation, by using the sourdough, I not only get a deeper flavor and a more complex dough, I also get a lot longer shelf life. So I get these really, and I also get what's, you know, considered to be more bioavailable bread products. I think, you know, anecdotally, there's a lot of concern about people eating bread and what it does to our guts. And I think, as we now see with all of the kombuchas and the fermentation process of things, that people are getting that they're kind of lighting to this idea that having something that's fermented is better for our gut, and I think the same idea can go with the bread. So all of these things sort of came together, and I've been basically R&Ding out of my kitchen for about 2 years, mm-hmm. And I almost quit the whole process. I had an opportunity to run into to talk to Ethan Stoll, and he tasted my bagels. He had about three or four of them in a sitting. and from then on, we had this relationship, and we're now moving forward together. I'm serving the bagels on a daily basis out of Cafe Cortina, which is in the second floor of 2 Union Square building at the intersection of 7th and Union. It's a little bit of a circuitous route to get to. It's in the base of an office building. That's 5 days a week I serve them. I bake them at fresh every day. And we're now looking for brick-and-mortar type spaces. It seems like it could happen in a few months or it could happen in a year. It just depends on when the right location shows up and that sort of thing.
The point you made about the fermentation, what I noticed about trying your bagels is when I eat a whole bagel, I don't feel good afterward. Right. Like my stomach, something happens in my stomach. Yeah. I'm not feeling good. Your bagel, I felt good after eating it, and I was full for like 3-4 hours. Yeah. And yeah, I didn't have that icky feeling that you have after just eating a giant glob of bread.
Yeah.
And I, you know, you gave me a few of them. They sat on my counter for 3 days, and in the morning I would slice it open and drop it in the toaster, and it was like a fresh bagel.
I mean, and there's bagels out there that are being produced in our city that they have a day shelf life at most, and it blows my mind. It's disappointing because they're great out of the oven. They have a good taste to them, but they don't ferment them, and they just turn into pucks.
Yeah.
You know, so I have had them sit for a really long time, and I'm really pleased that you can do that. You can do that without adding preservatives and without adding sort of artificial ingredients that just do worse things to our bodies than we need them to do.
Yeah.
My flour, I also, my flour is coming from, half of it comes from Washington State, which is really great. It's organic bread flour, which I'm really pleased to do. I'm trying to do as much organic and or locally sourced products. Certain things are impossible, like poppy seeds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Garlic might be more regionally, I guess, with tariffs going on. The garlic industry is actually booming as a result of the tariffs in the United States. So I might be able to get garlic locally or something like that. But, so it's been a lot of fun.
Bagels are such an interesting thing. I kind of gave up on bagels.
Yeah.
The last time I had... I was up in Montreal, and I had heard about the Montreal bagel and wood-fired, and that was very interesting to me. I looked at it. I even looked at trying to do something like it down here many years ago. Mr. Brown did that with Eltana bagels. But I still think that your point about the flour and the fermentation is really – they could use that too.
Yeah, well, they bang them out really fast. I mean, they just knock those things out.
Yeah. So I think that that's an area that needs to be explored.
Yeah.
Now, people love bagels.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily believe they belong in a sandwich, personally.
I agree with you.
but I do love them with butter or a schmear or a little bit of lox or something like that, that traditional way. What's your favorite way?
I like it with an egg.
An egg?
I like it with, I have a couple ways. I like an egg with cream cheese on it, and a chive cream cheese is what I like. I've also been really loving it with cream cheese and pickled onions and shallots on top of that. I am not a lox guy. I'm allergic to salmon, so I can't even touch it. But I have
to
agree with you.
That's a sad story. Right?
I know.
I'm so sorry.
I'm really sorry. I know I shouldn't have said it yet. But hey, at least I'm not pulling them out of the water.
Yes, that's right.
I'm one less person.
Yeah.
But I kind of agree with you. I have a hard time getting my mouth around a bagel sandwich.
Especially this style that you brought. They're very chewy.
Yeah.
I just don't know that they're meant for a sandwich.
Yeah.
Which some of those ones like the Thomas's or the Einstein or Noah's, they're all very fluffy.
You
like white bread, right?
That's because they're bread in bagel form. Yeah. They're not a bagel.
You could make them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You could make a soft bagel. You could make an egg bagel. You could do something like that. Yeah. I would prefer to sell a rye or a challah or a nice sourdough in the shop that you make the sandwiches out of.
Exactly.
And the person can, you know, at their own peril, they can have their own.
And at their own peril, they take the, like I say, you know, the New York bagel houses are lamenting the whole dig the dough out of the center and just leave the outside crust, right? That's been a big issue in New York City.
Yeah.
Everyone says, you know, scoop the dough.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Good luck on your process. It's nice to have an incubator bagel company on the way here. What do you guys think of the bagels? Delicious,
so good, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Andrew Rubenstein has been our guest. Look for his bagel shop to pop up somewhere in the next year or so. Up next, it's the Baker's Corner with Brittany Bartleben. We're going to chat about summer fruits on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. All right, we are back in the Seattle kitchen from the Hot Stove Society. Thank you all for being here. If you want to come join us, this tasty group, you guys are all tasty bagels, your tasty egg sandwiches, you want to be part of our group here, just go to hotstovesociety.com. Tickets are $20. You get a hot breakfast sandwich from the Dahlia Bakery, and of course, steamy coffee and tea and all those sorts of.
It's a lovely little morning date.
There's no, Bloody Marys.
No Bloody Marys, no. But it's, who needs a Bloody Mary on a Tuesday? It's.
As we talked earlier, you're just back from Prosser, but you're also in the middle of a baker's dream right now. And
yes.
We spend so many months of the year in that winter doldrums when it comes to fruit. And, you know, there's just fun things to explore in the wintertime. Pineapples, right?
Right.
And guava and a lot of the tropical things, which we feel is okay and somewhat seasonal at that time of year.
Yes. Yeah.
We're all good with. Just like we're good with coffee year-round. That's not a local ingredient.
No.
Yeah. Or chocolate is not a local ingredient.
Nuts.
Yeah. So... but generally, this is the time we dream about when all the local fruits are coming in. So right now, we have strawberries. I had a strawberry shortcake the other night that just brought me to tears.
Where'd you have it?
I had it at my daughter had her tasting for her wedding that's happening in September at the farm. So Chef Alex Chan had made it. At our tasting room at the catering warehouse. Anyway, the strawberries were spectacular and literally just sliced, set aside on the counter, and they macerated without any extra sugar, didn't need it. Just that dark ruby red centers and spectacular. And the shortcake was fabulous, too. So.
This is the time of year that, I mean, I don't really have to do anything other than just let the fruit be the fruit and give it some... some nudges along the way. The strawberries we got from Prosser Farm this year were absolutely the best strawberries I've ever tasted. They needed absolutely nothing. I did throw a few buds of those anise hyssop leaves in there we were talking about earlier. But yeah, I mean, it's so exciting this time of year because you need to do nothing more than to make a nice biscuit or a really perfect tart shell and some nice whipped cream, and you have a show-stopping, spectacular dessert. So... this is one of the ways I've grown as a chef, is to just get my ego out of there and just let the ingredient be the perfect, beautiful ingredient that it is. So this year, for the first time in years, I was like, I'm just going to make strawberry shortcake and put it on the Dahlia Lounge menu. I think of the Dahlia Lounge.
You say that. It's just, I'm just going to make it. And other people would say, well, that's a big deal.
Right. Yeah.
Because I know, but you live in that world every day. So strawberry shortcake seems pretty plain
very,
to you.
It's very, very easy for, but... it's really easy for anyone at home too. It's just a biscuit. It's a shortcake biscuit. So I'm doing a cream biscuit as opposed to like a really buttery buttermilk biscuit like you had that Alex made. But nothing could be easier. You can do it in your food processor. You can do it in your standing mixer, or you can do it with your hands in a big bowl. And it's just flour, sugar, baking powder, salt, and a little bit of butter. Not that much, less butter than you would think. Because then you're then adding heavy cream as your liquid. And I personally just think that makes a really, really lovely tender biscuit. Because it's the Dahlia Lounge, I'm taking it a little bit of a step further. And I took some of those really, really perfect Prosser strawberries that were honestly more that I could use in that one sitting. And I thinly sliced them and laid them out on a sheet tray and let them freeze solid. So I've now got individually quick frozen sliced strawberries. And then I throw those into the biscuit while they're still frozen, while I'm mixing that biscuit. And so then I've got essentially a strawberry biscuit. So, and I'm not really big on baked strawberries, say in like a pie or a cobbler. I think they turn sort of like this milky pink weird thing happens to them. But thinly slice in that biscuit, they sort of get intensified. You know, they're on the outside of the biscuit a little bit, so the sugars sort of get exposed to the oven and they caramelize. So I've got this strawberry biscuit, and then from there, it's just whipped cream and strawberries. We add a little bit of sugar and a pinch of salt to them just so that they get sort of their own sauce, and then a handful of sweet herbs on the plate, and that's all we're doing. And it's spectacular, and it's flying out of there.
Is it?
Yeah.
I bet it is. I mean, it's interesting, the whole idea. You know, so often people say pie dough or biscuits or something, shortcakes, try and keep that butter cold. Well, that's a good way to keep the butter a little colder.
Yeah.
By adding frozen berries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It cools that mixture down so that when it goes into the oven, your biscuits are super cold. And so that butter, rather than leaking out, once it hits that heat, the water that's in that butter produces steam, and that steam is what makes everything puff up. So that's why you want things to be super cold. But so, yeah, a little bit of frozen fruit in there is a really, really great way to ensure that you don't get a leaky unfortunate biscuit.
What, you know, the other one that's out right now, and you just picked a whole basket full of cherries.
Cherries.
All different. The Lamberts, the Vans, the Bings, the Sours.
The Lappins, yeah.
You know, Chef Terry was sitting here right now. He would say, just put them in a pan, a baking pan, pour your foodie mixture over top.
He sure would.
And he would say, don't even pit them.
Leave the pit in there.
Because that is a certain flavor, right? That's that almondy flavor
that
you get.
That noyo that is inside that, any stone fruit has this pit inside that has fantastic almond flavor.
It's very, very
French. Traditional
French
clafoutie does not bother to pit the cherries. Yeah. From a dining standpoint, we go ahead and take them out when we do clafoutie because we don't want broken crowns and lawsuits. So, yes, that's what Terry would do. I mean,
I was just going to say, I would suggest at home, try it one time.
Try it. Well,
I know it makes you crazy to think about it, but just try it. You'll really taste that almondiness of the cherry pit.
Or maybe do a little tasting, Matt, rather than bake a giant sheet tray or a giant pan of it. Make them smaller. And do a few with the pits and a few without and see if you can detect the difference. I think you really can. It just that flavor really permeates through the clafoutie. Clafoutie is one of my favorites. And I would agree with Chef Terry. That's a fantastic way to use your cherries. But if you're like me and you brought home a tote of 25 pounds of them, I would get to work on pitting them. I actually gave my son, this is the first thing I've really actually been able to get him to help me with in the kitchen rather than just making a mess, is I stripped him naked pretty much just down to his underpants, gave him a cherry pitter and a big bowl of cherries, and he sat there and pitted a bunch of them for me. Once they're pitted, again, you can IQF them, which is individually quick freezing them, laying them out on a sheet tray and getting them frozen solid. Once they're frozen solid, pack them into a Ziploc bag. And they freeze beautifully, and you can then use them the same way you would a fresh cherry.
Right, and the reason you IQF them is that when you go to the freezer and you want 6 for a smoothie or you want 24 for a clafoutie, they're individual, and you can just take as many as you want. You don't have a big block of cherries.
Exactly. Yeah. That's usually what we do with these cherries when they come over, because they come over in big amounts all at once. It's overwhelming, but we just get right to work pitting them, and then we've got cherries for the rest of the summer, and it's a real treat. Right now, what I'm doing with cherries is we've got a little bit of a rye flour brownie sundae at the Dahlia Lounge that I'm soaking those cherries in a little bit of a bourbon syrup. I'm not cooking them at all. I've got a little bit of a cherry syrup, and I'm adding bourbon to that, and then just pouring that directly over pitted cherries that have been sliced in half. And they just sit in that syrup, and it drinks up that bourbon flavor. So good with a brownie sundae. It'd be great in a cocktail. Yeah.
I love rye. Well, you could even use rye whiskey, I guess, instead of a rye, you know, bourbon style.
I do love rye, too. Yeah.
I would jump, for me, this is also a time to use those cherries, not strawberries as much for me, but cherries and plums and those types of things. The great little savory sauces. When you match them up with a little jalapeno or serrano that you char on the grill and you puree them with the fresh cherries, or you make a relish out of Walla Walla sweet onions and Bing cherries, or you take the plums, you know, the ripe plums, char jalapeno and char the plum skin, and then puree it up into a hot sauce. Basically, I made one on Jimi Hendrix's birthday a few years ago called Purple Haze, and Italian purple plums and roasted jalapenos, and we served the Purple Haze on halibut, of all things, and that was our Jimi Hendrix special.
You are so rock and roll, Tom.
Well, you know me, you know. So there's lots of things you can do with the fruit of the season. I think the IQF is important if you want to preserve. If you're making freezer jams and things like that, just recognize that those are 3/4 sugar, right?
Yes. Very little sugar needs to be added to them.
Right. You really don't. And you make a – you can't call a jam legal, I think. What is the word when you can't call a jam, but it's got – because it doesn't have enough sugar in it, basically.
You could call it a conserve, I believe.
Something like that.
Yeah. So. And to speak to that point, it's like, yes, I'm not having to do much to the fruit to serve it, but this is the time of year when you buy it up and preserve it so that you can enjoy it. That's what we're doing. We're not working to put – we're not putting a lot of work into the dessert that's going on the menu. We're putting a lot of work in behind the scenes to preserve this beautiful fruit that we're getting from.
And
I
loved what you said about getting out of the way. You know, we say that about salmon all the time. If you go out and get a Copper River King, what can you do on this earth to make that better?
Nothing.
Except don't screw it up, right? And it's the same way with a good cherry.
Don't screw it up. Yeah. Just get it done.
All right, up next, it's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. I believe Mr. Ned Bell is going to rejoin us for this, and maybe somebody will win something from Vancouver, BC.
Ooh.
On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's time for Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Brittany Bartleben.
And Mr. Ned Bell is joining us.
Good
Ned,
morning.
Ned, you were on earlier with your book called Lure. You also, are you running a restaurant at this point in your life or not?
I do a number of different things. I wear a few hats. I'm the culinary director at the Vancouver Club and the exec chef for the Oceanwise program across Canada. So I don't have a restaurant per se, but I still cook every day and... lots of times I cook for my family. Sometimes I cook for people. As long as I'm cooking sustainable seafood, I'm pretty happy.
There you go.
All right. I'm Tina Knoll, producer of this program. I'll be administering your quiz today, you guys. Here's how it all works, in case you're new to the game. Each of you will get five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner. Whoever gets the least amount of answers correct is the loser. And that loser has to give something away to a member of our audience. Today you'll be playing for the lovely Janice, who bravely came up to the microphone earlier today and joined us. So, Brittany Bartleben, we'll start with you. Should you lose the quiz today, what will you give to Janice?
Janice, you're going to get dessert and drinks for two at the Dahlia Lounge, so you can try everything I just talked about.
Nice. That is delicious.
Including the strawberry shortcake.
Including the strawberry shortcake.
Lovely.
Get there soon.
Yeah, exactly.
Ned, I feel like as the newbie here at the table, you are not going to lose. But should you lose, what will you give to...
I actually sort of hope that I'm going to lose today, strangely, because I get to give my new cookbook away, Lure. So, you know, it's a pretty good gift.
It's a beautiful book.
Hopefully you'll sign it, too.
I would love to sign it.
Okay. Chef Tom Douglas.
I will do a $100 gift card to the Palace Kitchen.
Which is
cooking and going crazy from 4:30 till 1 a.m. in the morning every night of the week.
Awesome. So Janice is rooting for nobody.
Yeah.
Today.
<Can't> lose.
Whoever loses, Janice wins. All right. Who would like to begin?
I'll go first.
All right, Miss Brittany. Your first question. Why does a pressure cooker cook foods faster? Is it A, same effect as crop circles? B, pressure causes food molecules to burst? C, it creates miniature thunderstorms? Or D, steam conducts heat better than air?
I'm going to go with the second one.
Same effect as crop circles?
No, I'm sorry. The one where pressure causes molecules to burst.
The
wrong?
Is
it the steam?
Yeah.
Okay. I knew it wasn't crop circles.
I was like, really? Guess again.
I really want her to come try my dessert.
All right. Question number two. Where is barbecue made with a vinegar-based sauce? Is it East North Carolina, Western North Carolina, Memphis, Tennessee, or St. Louis, Missouri?
Oh, I know it's one of the Carolinas.
Ugh.
Let's go with... I'm sorry, you said it was East or West Carolina? Is that what you said?
That's a minute detail.
I know. Really...
Seems
we don't do barbecue in Canada. I could answer this question. I would just say the U.S.
Yeah, that's how we do it in the United States. Let's go with East.
Let's go with West.
Then. West. How about West Carolina?
The answer is actually East.
Okay.
You got it right.
You got it correct. Very...
I know. I couldn't see through my glasses. They're super dirty. All right. One for one. One for two.
One for two.
One for two.
I'm on the board.
You are on the board. All right. How do you know if a brine is salty enough to cure meat or fish? You have some options here. A, makes your lips pucker. B, will draw water from eggplant. C, an egg will float in it. Or D, it will uncurl a sliver of scallion.
I've never tried any of these. They're very scientific. Let's go with the floating egg.
Yeah, the floating egg. Nicely. Exactly.
I hate when your lips pucker in a crop circle.
All right, question number four for you. The most common symptom of a food allergy is what? Hives, fatigue, breathing difficulty, or heart palpitations?
Let's go with breathing difficulty.
The answer is fatigue. Yeah, weird. It's a weird one. Two correct and two incorrect for your next question. Mm-hmm. A white wine noted for aromas of cut grass, fresh green herbs, and asparagus is what? Is it a Sauvignon Blanc, a Riesling, Zinfandel, or a Gamay?
Sauvignon Blanc.
Correct. Nicely done. That's 3 out of 5. More correct.
Way to go, Bartolabin.
Nice
job.
It's a nice showing. A very nice showing. All right, Ned, your first question. Which of these is an emulsion? Scotch whiskey, V8 juice, milk, or olive oil?
Milk.
Correct. Nicely done. Question number 2. What's the film that forms on heated milk? Fat globules, carbohydrate molecules, coagulated proteins, or lactose?
Lactose.
Answer is coagulated proteins.
Coagulated protein.
I mean, that seems unfair that was, to ask yeah. a newbie, right? Okay. Oh, so you have one correct and one incorrect. Your next question. Japanese eat this food for good luck on New Year's. Is it udon noodle soup, red snapper, spam, or sushi rice raked in real gold?
I'd say udon noodle soup.
The answer is actually red snapper. Question number 4 for you. Danish pastry originated in where? Denmark, Austria, France, or Norway?
Austria.
Correct. Nicely done.
I went to pastry school first, so I think some memories.
All right. Your last question. To tie with Brittany Bartolabin, what butter do professional chefs most often use? Salted stick butter, unsalted stick butter, whipped tub salted butter, or most chefs just use margarine?
Unsalted butter.
Correct.
Yes, I tied.
Tie, that's a tie. Tom Douglas, 3 is the number to beat today.
Okay.
All right, Chef Tom Douglas, question number 1. Acid-forming foods include eggs, meat, and poultry, B, fruits and vegetables, C, grains and legumes, or D, cheese and milk. Acid-forming
cheese
fruits.
And milk.
The answer is eggs, meat, and poultry. Question number 2. Professional chefs use this to peel ginger. European vegetable peelers, a utility knife, an ordinary teaspoon, or a long fingernail of a thumb?
I'll go with the teaspoon.
Yes, teaspoon it is. Really? Do you use that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, that's interesting.
It gets around the nubs.
Works like a dream.
Okay, Tom, question number 3 for you. Very often, leftovers that are reheated need additional seasoning. However, you should never add more pepper, salt, dried spices like oregano, or fresh herbs.
Salt.
Correct.
Because it doesn't go away, right? It's there somewhere.
And you could overdo it? Is that the...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Question number 4 for you. Prior to frying, food should be seasoned, scored, poached, pounded, or patted dry?
Patted dry, unless you want your eyeball taken out.
Wow. Tom, you've already tied. You got to get this one for like the absolute win. You ready?
Slash loss.
Slash loss. Fried oysters cooked with eggs and bacon is what? Pearl Diver hash, morning after, Hangtown fry, or Boston breakfast?
I'll say the Boston question, the Boston answer.
The answer is actually Hangtown fry. So, you guys, it's a 3-way tie. Now what do we do?
This has never happened.
Let's do a slap-off.
That slap-off.
Lo, the history of this show. Okay, let me find a good one then.
Or we can just give it all to Janice.
Let's let Janice decide. Yeah,
let's give it all to Janice.
Janice, it's your lucky day.
Wow.
If you want to be part of the show like Janice, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. And our sound engineer is Sean. Don't call me Del Torre, please. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to HotStoveSociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen. Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.